Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wilderness advocates are a dedicated lot, preserving that which is pristine, which enshrines the greatest wonders and values of the living realms, inspires great passion. So it was inevitable that when strategies for success take divergent paths, it would lead to a clash of passions. We hear another side to the wilderness debate when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. A few weeks back, the Wildside News went to the wilderness with Doug Scott of the Campaign for Wilderness and up to Idaho to talk about the successes expected in setting aside 300,000 new acres of wilderness, then off to the westward shores of the Pacific and the North Coast Wilderness Heritage Act that brought together various factions in a compromise legislation that has gained wide support. But there are those who see these not as real victories, but rather a compromise to the political climate that forces changes to interpretations of the Wilderness Act. During the next two segments, we talk with George Nickus, Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, who warns that such actions may in fact lead to inroads, both literal and figurative, into the legendary Wilderness Act that was set up to forever maintain the pure sanctity of the wilderness. As the legislative year comes to a close, there's going to be a lot of action that happens following a short break here at the end of the legislative year. And what that usually means is that a lot of bills get rammed through rather quickly. And in some cases, there's a lot of compromises that are formulated to try to make that happen. People in the wilderness community are concerned about what may be happening towards the end of this legislative year, and therefore have sent out an open letter to the conservation community calling for a moratorium on damaging public land and wilderness legislation. This is signed by 80 different environmental groups, particularly those concerned with wilderness and public lands. To help us understand the importance and the significance of this open letter, we're now talking with the Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, George Nickus. George, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the program, Sydney. Thank you.
First of all, why don't you give us a little background on Wilderness Watch?
Wilderness Watch is a national citizens organization that is uniquely focused on ensuring the lands that are in the National Wilderness Preservation System, our nation's wilderness areas, are protected and managed in a way that preserves those wild characteristics that which they were designated. We work on issues in wilderness all over the country, from Florida to Alaska, from Minnesota to California, and trying to make sure that this wonderful wilderness heritage that we have set aside in the United States is preserved forever.
The original Wilderness Act had some very strong provisions in terms of what was allowed and what was not allowed in wilderness areas, and I think that gets to the heart of some of this current concern. Why don't you first of all describe how you wish to see wilderness preserved?
Well, you're right. The Wilderness Act of 1964, which established the wilderness system and designated the first, nearly 10 million acres of wilderness in the country, is a very restrictive piece of legislation. It's written with the full intention and the legal mandate that the wilderness character of these areas has to be preserved. And it provides for a lot of different uses of those areas: hiking, camping, fishing, hunting, lots of recreational opportunities, but that everything that occurs in these areas must happen in a way that preserves their wilderness character for both present and future generations, and to keep them as secure habitats for a lot of the species, both endangered and otherwise, that need that kind of habitat to survive. So it was a very forward-looking document. It's incredibly unique in the world, really, because it established for the first time a statement by a people and a government that said, you know, some places we're just going to leave alone. We're going to let nature do its thing. We're going to let nature roll the dice, and we're going to accept the outcomes of that and appreciate it and study it and learn from it. but that it was really sort of nature's bill of rights. Some places we're just going to leave alone as human beings. And that was a really novel idea. It took 8 years to get that bill passed through Congress, many, many hearings and a lot of public support, but ultimately it passed Congress almost unanimously. And I think there was just a real strong feeling that that was a wonderful idea. And it's that idea of having these areas set aside where nature reigns and people visit, but we don't modify them, we don't change them, all of those kinds of things that makes the wilderness system so popular still. And in order to do that, of course, it requires restraint on the part of visitors and on the part of managers and others to not manipulate these areas, to not harm these areas, to not do inappropriate things. The Wilderness Act prohibits motorized vehicles. It prohibits any sort of mechanized transportation. It prohibits structures and installations. It prohibits road building. It does a lot of things like that to make sure that these areas are kept wild long into the future.
For close to 40 years, it seems as if that legislation was fairly sound and intact. But then the concern within the larger environmental community is that something began to change with the current administration, and there began to be really quite a concerted effort to start to create inroads, in literal and figurative words, into this legislation and the protections. Let's talk about that a bit.
Well, that's true, Sidney, and it may even predate this administration. I think it really goes back to probably the early 90s when the leadership in Congress changed. And even though the Wilderness Act and the wilderness system has always received very, very bipartisan support in the country, a number of folks became in charge of important committees, etc., in Congress who had stated from time to time that they wanted to rewrite the Wilderness Act, or they thought the Wilderness Act was too restrictive. They wanted to allow a bunch of activities that had heretofore been considered inappropriate to occur inside of wilderness. And in specific cases, we started to see legislation that was geared at weakening protections of individual wilderness areas. For example, in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness up in the North Country of Minnesota, there was a legislative rider attached to a transportation bill, totally unrelated bill, but they attached a rider that allowed these motorized portages in the wilderness where you could actually take trucks into the wilderness and haul boats from one lake to another lake. And that was the first time that we saw the protection for an individual wilderness weakened. We've seen other situations since then on the Cumberland Island Wilderness, which is the largest undeveloped barrier island off the eastern seaboard. It's down off the coast of Georgia, a wonderful place. But in the last session of Congress, we saw the area carved up by roads through legislation, where they actually took this one intact wilderness area and divided it up into several areas and are allowing motor vehicles to travel on these corridors in between the areas. So we've seen those kinds of problems crop up in the wilderness system. It's very troubling because, you know, in the preamble to the Wilderness Act of 1964 talked about we were going to set aside areas for the permanent good of the whole people. The whole idea being that once we established an area as wilderness and designated it as wilderness, it was going to be preserved forever. It was a real pact with the future, if you will, a contract with the future that we'd preserve these areas. But we've seen that starting to be whittled away. Now what we see, which is a little bit of a different problem in some of these new wilderness bills, and one of the key reasons that we've called for and joined with these other 80 organizations in calling for a moratorium on some of these bills, is that these bills that are designating new wildernesses are including all kinds of special provisions, all kinds of compromises that allow things to occur inside of wilderness that are really counter to the Wilderness Act and what it sought to achieve. And we're very concerned, and we've seen this as in our day-to-day work of trying to preserve these areas that are already designated we see how these special provisions are really eroding the idea of wilderness and that sanctity of the wilderness system and what it means. And so we're very concerned because a lot of these new provisions in these so-called wilderness bills are changing the nature of what wilderness is about. So there's a lot of things happening out there that are putting these special places at risk.
What is evolving is quite a debate within the wilderness community itself, where although the intentions are the same, and that is to set aside and preserve these miraculous lands for all time in a pristine form, some would say that from a practical standpoint, we have to make certain types of compromises in order to succeed at some level. And I guess this begins to define what the current debate is about, which is this concept of the quid pro quo approach to wilderness preservation. I think from my perspective, what it comes down to is a war over public lands and taking away public lands and also opening them up to more and degrading uses, just as almost a strategy such that if you get your foot in the door, well, probably it's very hard to turn it back. From your perspective, is this a well-organized attempt to kind of soften all of the public lands legislation?
Absolutely. It's an orchestrated effort, and it goes back quite a long time. There was an organization, a lot of your the program listeners will be familiar with the term the Wise Use Movement, which started really getting some legs under it back in the 1980s. With the Sagebrush Rebellion and some of those efforts to roll back all the public land protections. And it was heavily funded by some of the extractive industries, and they used to put some citizen groups as front groups out there to make it look like a grassroots effort, but it was really being funded by the mining and logging and other industries. And it's morphed into a lot of different organizations. One of them was a group called the Wilderness Act Reform Coalition. And the Wilderness Act Reform Coalition put out a sort of its manifesto, and it listed something like 26 points that it wanted to achieve. And many of those points are starting to show up in wilderness bills today. These folks have been at this for a long time, and they're patient, and they use their connections on the inside, and they wait until the political winds are blowing the way they want them to blow, and then they strike. And they're striking in a number of these so-called wilderness bills or public lands bills, quid pro quo bills, as you referred to them, where they're getting their way through these new pieces of legislation. You know, the former Secretary of Interior, Stuart Udall, who was Interior Secretary when the Wilderness Act was passed, once said that, you know, the Wilderness Act will never be repealed. It's just too popular as a law. But what will happen is we'll see efforts to chip away at it one piece at a time. And that's exactly what we're seeing here, are efforts to chip away at that one piece at a time. It's not just the Wilderness Act. It's public lands in general, and you alluded to that, and it's so true that the whole idea that we're using our public lands as sort of bartering chips in order to get other things done, they're being used as sort of chattel to buy political favors in some of these wilderness bills, where our public lands are being given away to private development interests. And what Congress is doing, though, and what is really sort of nefarious here, is that they're attaching wilderness designations to these bills that otherwise would be seen for what they are. They're just development bills. They're giveaway bills. They're very, very, very poor public legislation, and they're putting in some wilderness designations to give them a green veneer and to try to buy off support from some of the conservation community and to minimize the opposition to these bills by some of the conservation community. And that's just really, really unfortunate. And what makes matters even worse is that even those wilderness designations that are included aren't real wilderness. They're not authentic wilderness. They're allowing all kinds of things to occur in these areas that would not normally be allowed. So, there are things like, many of us recently were alarmed when the state of Idaho proposed to go into the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, which is the largest wilderness in the lower 48, they wanted to go in with helicopters and dart wolves, these wild wolves, inside there, dart them, land, collar these wolves, get collars on them, so that they could go back in later and find all the wolf packs in there when they wanted to wipe them out. And, oh, everybody was just up in arms that they were going to do this and saying, you can't do that, it's wilderness, you can't go in there with helicopters and dart all the wolves. And yet there's legislation in Idaho right now for to designate part of the Boulder White Clouds as wilderness, and some of the Owyhee country's wilderness, that would allow that very thing to go on. So we're seeing folks who can't achieve what they want to achieve because of the Wilderness Act starting to implement special provisions in new bills that would allow them to do that sort of stuff. And this isn't, you know, as you mentioned earlier, this isn't something that is just now happening. It's something that these groups have been working toward, these anti-wilderness, sort of anti-public lands groups, have been working toward for a long time. And we first saw it in the Wilderness Bill in Oregon several years ago, back around, I'd say 2000, and then it started popping up in Nevada, a couple of bills that have passed in Nevada, the Clark County Bill and the Lincoln County bills in Nevada, had all of these kinds of provisions, and now we're seeing them in the Boulder White Clouds, the so-called Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, is putting all these special provisions in. We're seeing it in a Washington County bill in Utah now, a White Pine County bill in Nevada again, and now in the Owyhee Canyonlands country of Idaho. So it's not just a quirk that we're seeing a couple things. It's not an anomaly. It's a pattern that's been developing for a long time.
The strategy by this side, when we're talking about public lands, people who are really trying to take the public lands out of the public domain in one way or another, they realize oftentimes that to do it directly is not going to fly. So unfortunately, and it's been a very effective, a brilliant, rather secret strategy, is to change things through administrative fiat or through changing regulations as opposed to through legislation. And I guess that gets at the heart of this, that what is happening is that for example, a wilderness bill can be, that is, as you say, is designating land that really doesn't qualify for wilderness, but it sets that precedent, and that's a bad precedent to set, because then that becomes the basis for looking back at another time and saying, well, look, it was done here, it was done here, it was done here, and that's the danger. And I think that gets to what your open letter is about, and that is that you really are trying to make people aware of the fact that we must hold to the original concept of wilderness, particularly right now.
Absolutely. You know, now, unfortunately, is not a good time to be passing wilderness bills, because we have a leadership in Congress and in the administration that is almost anathema to wilderness. They don't believe in it, they don't like it, and the point that they're making to the conservation community is that if you want wilderness, you're going to have to pay a very heavy price for it. And many of us are looking at that and saying the price isn't worth it. For one reason, in most situations, if the areas aren't designated today, they're not going to disappear tomorrow. We'll have another chance. The political winds will change, whether it's this year, next year, 5 years from now. It will happen. There will be more support for wilderness. We'll have opportunities to get wilderness bills that do justice to the idea of wilderness and to the wilderness system. But what we have right now is a situation where Congress is exacting a very high price. And sometimes you have to step back and say, there are many other ways to protect these lands without designating them wilderness today, and we need to put our efforts in that direction. And when the opportunity is right, that's when we'll get additional wilderness. And wilderness always has. Most, even though the wilderness system today is now 100 million acres in size, it tends to come in lumps. It tends to come at times when the planets get aligned just such and there's an opportunity and you get good legislation through. Now just isn't one of those times. People are using these bills to promote all kinds of agendas that aren't in the public's interest and certainly aren't in the interest of public lands.
Give us some examples of these trade-offs that you find most egregious.
I would probably put the most egregious things into three categories. One of them is the outright giveaway of public lands, which the Central Idaho Bill does. It gives public lands to local communities so that they can then sell those lands for private development. So basically, we're using our public lands in order to fund local projects. In other cases, the federal government, the public lands are being sold in these bills. The agencies are being told to sell these certain parcels of land, and then that money comes back, and a portion of that money is used to fund local projects. So essentially, we're using our public lands as a cash cow for local communities, et cetera, and private developers in order to make money. And I think, you know, that's the very thing that the public screamed about when the Bush administration came out with a proposal earlier this year to sell some of our national forest lands in order to pay for the communities impacted by the lessening of the harvest of timber on public lands and to help support schools and all in those communities. And people said, our public lands aren't out there to be sold to pay for programs that we ought to be, if they're worthy of funding, we ought to be funding in other ways. So the selling and giving away of public lands is a huge problem. A second big problem, and the one that our organization is focused on, are some of these provisions that allow motor vehicle use inside of wilderness, snowmobiles, ATVs, helicopters, airplanes, etc. in wilderness, that allow these kinds of manipulative actions with respect to wildlife, and also with the control of fire, where it would allow local communities, counties, state governments, etc., to make decisions about firefighting, etc., in these wilderness areas. And so, that'll be very destructive. It's a guarantee. But there's also a third thing, and it's related to that in a sense, that what some of these bills do, such as this Owyhee Canyons bill, is we talked a few minutes ago about the old Sagebrush Rebellion and the efforts back in those days to actually transfer federal lands to state and local governments. Well, that failed. The public screamed bloody murder about that. So what they're trying to do is get control of them in another way. And so what they're doing in these bills is they're creating local management committees and local management teams of local people, like local ranchers, local landowners, etc., that become advisory teams to the federal government at the local level, and they set policy for how our public lands will be managed. And so if they can't shift ownership of the land, they've essentially shifted control of those lands to these local entities to make decisions. And so it goes right back to the provision I mentioned with wilderness, where they're going to allow local and state agencies some control over fire management in these places. In other instances, they're simply granting a lot of the decision-making responsibilities on public lands to these local-based steering committees and steering teams that the legislation's establishing. And they're always jam-packed with special interest groups that have their own, you know, personal interest involved by what the decisions that are made there. So it's kind of shifting the control of our public lands toward more private interests and local government interests. So I think those are three of the biggest problems with the way these new bills are being written and the kinds of things that they would allow.
We're taking a short break, and we'll continue our discussion with George Nickus when your Voice of the Earth returns. We'll be right back.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.